Members, call a meeting of the Property Taxes and Local Government Finance Committee to order. We will start off with the minutes from the last meeting, from the February 4th meeting. Is there a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Simonson moves to approve the minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented? Hearing none, the minutes stand approved as presented. Or actually, I think we got to vote on that, don't we?
Yeah.
All in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Sorry about that. Our first bill is Representative Yu Akeem, and the bill is House File 473, and we'll begin with that bill and then bring the other two forward. Representative Yu Akeem, would you want to begin by moving your bill? We'll be laying this one over for possible inclusion.
Yes, I would like to move House File 473 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report.
Thank you, Representative Yu Akeem, if you want to proceed in presenting your bill.
All right. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to discuss House File 473 today. Since this is the first time I've presented a bill in front of the body, I brought treats as per tradition. Normally, I would make you stuff, hand-make stuff, but I have a cold, so I know you'd appreciate me not touching your food, so there's chocolates on the end of the table.
Wow, thank you.
Many of you are familiar with the tax incentive program called This Old House that was phased out for new applicants in 2003. This brings that program back and includes a similar program for owner-occupied commercial and industrial buildings. Before being elected to the House, I served on the Hopkins City Council for 9 years. Hopkins is a small town. It's 2 by 2 miles just west of Minneapolis. We are unique in that we still have a traditional Main Street and old commercial buildings and a large percentage of older homes. Our residents continually struggle to find ways to maintain and improve their homes that fit in their pocketbook. A program like This Old House would give them an incentive to fix up their older homes without immediately worrying about the burden of increased taxes offsetting the benefits of their improvements. I've also continuously heard from small business owners along our Main Street that they would like to improve their property, but worry about seeing the exact amount of their improvement show up as an increase on their property assessment. They want to make the improvements, but they need just a little bit of help. This bill allows homes under $400,000 in value over 30 years old that make at least a $5,000 assessed improvements to their home to deduct that increase from their tax assessment amount before taxes are calculated for 10 years. The house, like I said, has to be over 30 years old. You cannot raise more than 50% of the property, and you can't double the size of the structure. For an owner-occupied commercial or industrial building that is over 30 years old, there has to be an assessed value of under $2 million. The improvement has to add at least 12% onto the market value, and the same 50% rule applies. I've heard from some people, and particularly the assessors, that are worried about the exclusion of portions of property in jurisdictions shifting taxes to other properties in the same jurisdiction. I can understand that concern. But for those of you who live in smaller towns like ours that are all over Minnesota, you know and understand the symbiotic relationship between a Main Street or a business district and housing districts and how they affect each other, and if one does well, the other does well too. I think it's important to understand that this program was originally designed to provide owners of older homes and businesses with an additional incentive and take away the disincentive to renovate their property, and in turn, preserve and revitalize older neighborhoods and main streets. I'm not wedded to this specific approach. I'm open to and value any discussions or suggestions that lead to some sort of program that would achieve the same goal. Our communities need programs like this to keep their economies vital and strong. In your packet, you're going to find a brief one-page description of the program, along with a chart that House Research put together that gives some examples of how this old shop would work and could monetarily benefit a commercial or industrial property. And the bill's drafted to really focus on smaller, older commercial industrial properties, not huge strip malls. There's exclusions for that. And how this old house could also work on an average-priced home. There's also a revenue analysis that shows a small savings to the general fund if this program is put in place. And there's, I apologize for the last minute letter from a business owner that talks about the impacts. I have a few people here today to testify with me on the program's benefits. I've got Heather Corcoran from the, she's the International Governmental Relations Liaison for the League of Minnesota Cities. She will give us a little more detail on the history and the program. There's Mike Morrison, the city manager of Hopkins, and Andrew Peters, who's a council member from Lake City. They will both speak about the program and the local impact that it could have. One thing to keep in mind, the last year that this old house was taking new properties in 2003, in Hennepin County alone, Hopkins, even though we're 2 by 2 miles, we were the third biggest user of the program. Our residents really, really needed it. I have Shelley Billiette here. She's a homeowner who actually used this old house, and she has the added perspective of being a real estate agent. And then Doug Gasek, who's the executive director from the Preservation of Alliance of Minnesota. So with that, I would like to turn it over and bring Ms. Corcoran up to the table from the League of Minnesota Cities.
Representative Joachim, if we could, I'd like to maybe, can we change the order? Is that
sure.
Okay? Let's bring up Mr. Morrison and Mr. Peters first, and Mr. Cummins would like to testify, and he needs to head over to the Senate, and so I'm going to suspend our tradition here of having government people wait till last for him. But let's proceed with, because these two may be shorter presentations.
Yes, yeah, thank you. And I know Mr. Morrison needs to get back to a meeting in the city. So
excellent. Thank you. Thanks for coming today, Mr. Morrison. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Morrison, the city manager of Hopkins. And I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today. I also want to thank Representative Joachim for introducing this bill. In her former life, she was one of my bosses as a council member, and she never brought me treats to a council meeting. So you guys should feel pretty special. Hopkins is 13 miles west of the Twin Cities. We're 18,000 people. We have over 300 businesses that employ over 13,000 employees with just in our city limits. There's two points I want to make is, as Representative Joachim talked about, we have a great Main Street, and we've been investing a lot in our Main Street. We have over 181 businesses in the city of Hopkins that would qualify from this program, and about 100 of them are on Main Street. And talking to the property owners and developers of our Main Street, building owners, some of the things that are keeping them from reinvesting in their buildings are making these buildings convert to current building and fire codes. We just purchased a building, the city council, that was housed the Masonic Lodge. It was built in 1901. And the reason we purchased it, because we were concerned that a developer would come in and just tear it down. And we just think it was important to have preservation and to convert it to current ADA standards and sprinkler standards that the fire code requires just would have made it prohibitive for any developer from trying to renovate that. So this would help continue to invest in our Main Street and preserve older buildings within the city of Hopkins. Second component for Hopkins is we have an unusual housing stock. We have 55 to 60% rental to 45 to 40% single family homes. And the council, besides Main Street, their second priority is to preserve our single family home ownership. And we would have about 2,500 homes that would qualify under the way this is proposed at under 400,000 value and being over 30 years old. So we could see this as a way to continue to rent, improve our avenues, homes, and some of our homes in North Hopkins that potentially could be taken down and new homes being put up and just kind of preserve the housing stock to have a developer come in and buy a block of homes and put an apartment complex in there. We want to try to get a better balance. So we would benefit. I'm also need to let you know that I'm a board member for the League of Minnesota Cities, and the League Board has this as one of their top priorities. We have a policy committee made up of 150 city officials throughout the state, and they have this recommended as one of their top priorities, which would preserve housing stock and commercial stock, not just in the metro, but throughout the entire state of Minnesota. And that really concludes my mark, and I want to thank you again, Chair and Representative Joachim, for considering this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Questions for Mr. Morrison before he gets back to his day job, members? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering, would this affect the older home component of the LGA formula?
Mr. Morrison.
Representative Chair, Representative, I am not sure. I'm not sure how that whole formula works. Somebody else is smarter than me that could probably answer that.
Ms. Dalton or Mr. Hines will respond.
Mr. Chairman, it would not affect that, the LGA formula. If the home is over 40 years, it wouldn't matter if they were getting assistance under this program or not. It would still be counted in the LGA formula.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Other questions for Mr. Morrison? Mr. Morrison, thank you for your testimony here today. Mr. Peters.
Mr. Chair, Andrew Peters and I served on the Local Economies Committee for the League of Minnesota Cities.
And Mr. Peters and I are well acquainted, but Mr. Peters, please go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Jorkowski. Good morning, and members of the division. My name is Andrew Peters. I sit on the City Council for the City of Lake City, the birthplace of water skiing. I'm also the council liaison for our Economic Development Board. Lake City is a small rural city located on Lake Pepin, which is part of the Mississippi River system in southeastern Minnesota, with an approximate population of about 5,000 year-round residents. Our city has a good manufacturing business base with a top 10 business entity employing 2,131 people, or 43% of our population. What we are experiencing is that approximately 65% of these workers choose to live outside of Lake City because of perceived high housing and rental costs and not earning a salary to afford these residences. Local real estate firms, who I've talked with a number of them, are indicating they entertain many prospective home buyers or business buyers who want to purchase and move into a home or a business reasonably priced with little or no upgrade costs, almost like they want to come in turnkey. We have many residents available at a very low cost, but to make these homes to a perceived livable condition for young buyers or retirees will take too much money to upgrade, and thus the building becomes out of reach for affordability and remains empty. And when I was campaigning a few years back, I counted over 200 homes that did not have for sale signs or foreclosure signs, and the insides are totally empty. As you are well aware, older homes in need have proven to have lower assessed values than the newer homes that are ready to move into. Many young families or retirees cannot afford higher property tax assessments nor have funds to improve their residences for livability. Thus, they look elsewhere. This then makes for our local businesses to try to find qualified workers to look outside of our area, specifically throughout southeastern Minnesota and in western Wisconsin, for workers who are already established in those communities and quite often will not move and they do not mind a commute, which is another topic. The community, our city, will lose out on potential property tax revenues, utility revenues, and our children headcount for our great local education system. As you well know, school population is a direct impact on funding they receive, so that we're struggling on that point as well. We also have numerous empty storefronts of buildings built 100 or more years ago in great need of much repair, upgrade, becoming ADA compliant, modernizing the interior, replacing all utilities, of which many potential buyers stay away from. We had a closed restaurant, Century Building, was put on the auction at $102,000, not even one inquiry to purchase the building. And this is typical of a lot of our buildings in our downtown. A city of our size for economic development needs many tools to have available to employ to encourage prospective business owners and residents to move into our small river town. Being on the EDA board at one time, I counted we've got over 19 tools that we can use for incentives, but in any given situation, I found we typically cannot use more than two of them. And so almost every scenario, there's different tools because there's a variety of requirements and needs and assessments. And so with the passage of this bill, it'll allow us to have another tool, especially for in the financial incentive side, to make our community more desirable to live and work in. Thank you for allowing me to speak before the board.
Thank you, Mr. Peters. Questions for Mr. Peters? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jokowski.
Mr. Cummings, Are you available to testify? Good morning, Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for, my name is, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Department of Revenue. I did speak to Representative Joaquim yesterday about the bill, and also about the important public policy goals that I know that she's working to address in this bill. Mr. Chair, I do need to leave after my testimony to go to the Senate, but I did want to let you know that our Assistant Director in the Property Tax Division is here if there's any questions about assessment or valuation or anything that may come up on a technical side.
Thank you.
This bill authorizes a value exclusion for certain improvements to homestead and commercial industrial property. So in essence, as Representative Joaquim said, it revives the this old house exclusions that were currently set to phase out. This bill would place value judgments for assessing properties that are not based on market value. We currently have many tools to recognize behaviors or situations in the tax code, including various class rates, credits, aids, and refunds. And you know, sometimes tax credits are a really blunt instrument used to go after a really targeted goal. This proposal would exclude part of the value from market value of a home or business. So like this old house and limited market value were examples of programs that distorted the market by placing values on properties not linked to market value. The original intent of this old house was to keep historic homes from being raised originally, but it was also used for other purposes. Many times older homes had central air put in and received an exclusion rather than, you know, other structural updates. In most, if not all cases, their this old house value would increase their market value homestead exclusion, creating additional benefits that, again, are not tied to market value. I just wanted to note that under this bill, the phase-in provisions would be probably difficult to administer. There's limited capabilities of assessment software to compute correctly the phased-in value of the excluded value. So this is going to take a lot of hands-on assessment work. And if the predictions in terms of the numbers of taxpayers that would be involved, that may lead to many errors. We're also sort of thinking about the what happens in terms of multiple improvements that had separate exclusion start dates and phase-out years. So this would take quite a bit of work in terms of providing additional education and updating materials and fact sheets and manuals and the rest. So I know, Mr. Chair and Representative Joaquim, we look forward to working with you to think about this important public policy goal and maybe the best ways of trying to think about this as you put together your division report.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings, or maybe Mr. Hines or somebody, could you or somebody review for the committee the history of this in law? It's been in law in some form or another in the past, or maybe Representative Joaquim has that for us.
Yes, I do. It was in 10 years. It started in 1993 and phased out in 2003. And then there's some varying reports on a program that was similar to this old house being available during that same time period, too. I know Heather Corcoran can speak a little bit more to that later in the testimony. And in the revenue note, the assumption is that 65 homeowners statewide would use this program. 6,500, sorry. 65 homeowners statewide would use this program in each year, and maybe 100 businesses.
Thank you, Representative Joaquim. Questions for Mr. Cummings? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, I just want to make sure I understood. When you talk about the phase-in being a challenge, were you talking about the... I guess I was thinking of it as the phase out. After 10 years of being excluded, then the 50% over 2 years or 20% over 5 years, is that what you were referring to?
Yeah.
Mr. Cummings.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess I'm wondering, and this may be a question for Representative Joachim or for one of the testifiers, but how much value there is, because it does seem like after the 10 years that does get complicated. You got to do these calculations and all, and it seems like a pretty good incentive to already have 10 years of being excluded. I'm wondering what a difference it might make if that that phase-in period was just taken off and after 10 years was simply added to the rules. What a difference the phase-in period makes.
Representative Joachim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, you actually read my mind. When I first was looking at that program, I thought it was going to be a blink-off, and that would just go back on the tax rolls. And I'm like I said, I'm very open to trying to reach the goals in different ways as well.
Other questions for Mr. Cummings? Thank you, Mr. Cummings, and good luck on your travels to the Senate.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the special dispensation I've been received from the chair today on allowing us government folks a little early.
Well, Mr. Cummings, don't expect it again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Next on the list, Representative Joachim, would we like to proceed with Ms. Corcoran?
That would be wonderful. Thank
okay.
you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Corcoran, if you would like to come up. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heather Corcoran. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Liaison with the League of Minnesota Cities, the statewide association for 852 cities around the state. I'll make my comments somewhat brief, but be available for questions so that we can hear from the other testifiers who aren't government folks or lobbyists. The League is interested in this issue because we've heard from cities that they're looking for tools to use for economic development and to revitalize neighborhoods and communities. House File 473 would provide tools to do that. Cities are looking for ways to help take away the immediate impact that improving one's property can have on their property taxes. This legislation is designed to provide owners of older homes and businesses an incentive to preserve and revitalize their main streets and neighborhoods. The bipartisan bills in the House and Senate have the support of the League, Metro Cities, which is an association for metro area cities, and the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, which is having their day on the Hill today. In a 2004 Department of Revenue report, it said that this old house, when it existed for 10 years, had 57,000 properties that utilized it in all but one county. Lake of the Woods County was the one that did not have any properties that utilized the program previously. As Representative Joachim said, businesses and homes need to be at least 30 years old to qualify, and there's a phase out, there's a period of 10 years where the increased assessed value is not added onto the property taxes, and then after that it's phased in. You asked, just to address quickly, the history. This old shop was also existed, began in 1997, and it was effective until improvements made up to 2003, and then it stopped accepting new applicants. And that year was also the last year for this old house for new applicants to start applying for the program, but properties may still be receiving the benefit since the phase out of up to 15 years. With that, I'll be available for questions now or later.
Great. Questions for Ms. Corcoran. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Corcoran, wouldn't this be a nightmare for assessors? I mean, I think about my assessors and how frequently they come to assess my property. Now, if I make improvements, they're going to have to make continued visits. And rural Minnesota, I'm not sure that's going to fly very well. So do you have a solution for that?
Ms. Corcoran.
Representative Erickson. I don't represent the assessors. I guess if they want to speak to that, they could, since they did administer the program previously. We feel that it's an important public policy goal to provide tools, and we're open to other mechanisms. The League is also open to providing incentives in other ways or going about it in different ways to help deal with the burdens that might be placed.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Joachim.
Representative Erickson, I again am open to other avenues, whether or not it be limiting property to only being able to utilize the program once, so that they're thoughtful, you know, think about all their improvements they're going to do, so the assessors would only have to do it once. There's other areas in taxes where we do have assessed value effect. We had House File 140 last week, and that's the tax, let me see, I can remember right, it was the targeting property tax refund, and that's where actually if any improvements were made to the home since the previous year, the portion of the tax increase resulting from the improvements must be subtracted when determining the refund. So, I mean, they're doing some of that already with some of our other programs.
Is there an assessor in the house? would you like to speak to that question? Please come up.
Mr. Chair, should we just have the assessor then do their presentation at this point?
Oh, they're on our list.
Yes, so I didn't know if you wanted to go to some constituents I have here to speak or to the assessors.
Let's direct this question. If you want to just address Representative Erickson's question, introduce yourself, please, and then you can come back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm a retired Hennepin County assessor, and I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I do have a prepared statement. I don't know if you want me to do that now, as long as I'm here.
If you could wait with that, we just want to get a response to what Representative Erickson was asking.
This old house, as we've known it since 1993, assessors have been opposed to that. It is a lot of work. It is complex. It's one of those things that once was put into law that we did. It's been mentioned that in 2003, when Department of Revenue did their annual report, there was approximately 57,000 parcels in the state that were on this old house and over $700 million of value that was excluded. So it is a difficult program, as many of the programs are. I would only say that whenever these programs that take administrative time and effort to perform, assessors step up to the plate, they do that. But once we have those, it takes time away from doing what we really are trained to do, and that's valuing property.
Thank you, Mr. Hamm. Representative Erickson? Okay. Next we'll have, and Mr. Hamm will call you back up soon. Next we have Ms. Billiatt?
Billiatt, yes.
Billiatt.
Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Billiatt, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. I'm Shelley Billiatt. I am a homeowner in Hopkins, and my husband and I we took advantage of this old house credit twice. We used it, our home was built in 1902. So when we purchased the home, there was a very narrow horse barn still on the property, so we took that down and built an oversized two-car garage. So that was the first time we used the program. The second time was to finish our basement, add a bathroom, laundry room for our growing family. So for us, it really helped. It gave us that extra incentive to do the things that we wanted to do to our home. We lived in that home for 21 years and just moved to another older home in Hopkins. Our tax exclusion value is $11,000. It wasn't a huge amount of an exclusion, but you know, it was just enough. It was that little nudge that gave us the opportunity to take advantage of a program. I'm also a realtor in my community, and as Mr. Mortensen said earlier, our housing stock is old. We have a lot of 1900s homes, pre-World War II homes, and I have a lot of clients that love living on the avenues. And with that, I get calls a lot on this program when it was in place, and then also they want to stay on the avenues, but their homes are either lacking a bathroom, lacking size. So I think that this, again, is another incentive for homeowners to stay in our community and add on to their homes. And I just say I would personally love to see this program come back into play. I think it's a win-win for our downtown and for our communities.
Thank you, Ms. Billiatt. We've got a question from Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for appearing with us today. Would you have made the improvements without this credit to build your oversized garage?
Ms. Billiatt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we would have. Yes.
Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Billiatt? Ms. Billiatt, thank you for your testimony here today. And next on the list, we have Mr. Gasick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Gasick, and proceed.
My name is Doug Gasick, and I'm the Executive Director of the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, the only statewide nonprofit organization in Minnesota dedicated to preservation and adaptive reuse of historic and established places in our communities. One of our core programs at the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota is Minnesota Main Street. Main Street is an asset-based economic and community development tool, and Main Street's primary assets are really the people and the heritage of our communities. Historic downtowns provide a natural incubator for local entrepreneurs, and these businesses are really central to the local economic stability of our communities. Since 2010, when Main Street reemerged in Minnesota, 7 communities have been designated throughout the state: Wilmer, Red Wing, Owatonna, Shakopee, Winona, Faribault, and New Ulm. In addition to those 7 designated Main Street communities, there's 30 associate level communities throughout the state. In this short amount of time, 4 years, the Preservation Alliance has collected data from those seven designated Main Street communities. In 4 years, there's been 155 building rehabs in those 7 towns, representing $7 million of private investment. And through this concentrated effort, 63 new businesses were created and 210 jobs were created in those 7 communities. Over the past 4 years, we've really witnessed how preservation incentives can create jobs and inspire investment in our communities through Minnesota's rehab tax credit. The reason why so many jobs are created in preservation projects is that preservation projects are just more labor intensive. Nearly 70% of project budgets go into labor, while new construction relies more on a 50-50 split, 50% going into materials and 50% going into labor. Increased labor results in greater income and sales tax revenues for our state. We've seen great success in the historic tax credit over the years, but this tax credit is only available to properties that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places. To date, there's only 29 commercial historic districts in Minnesota. The majority of the 7 Main Street communities that we have out there don't have commercial districts. So that means the great downtowns in Red Wing and Owatonna and Shakopee and Wilmer, most of their buildings aren't going to qualify for the rehab tax credit. So that's why we feel like another tool is really needed to help some of those rehabs of historic buildings take place. In short, rehabbing a historic building is really a powerful act of development that creates jobs and income. Because of the labor intensity of rehabilitation and the relatively high wages of workers, very few industries create more jobs and household income than preservation. So let's keep encouraging development of our historic buildings and keep the cores of our community strong. And this bill will help do that. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Gasick? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My impression was this bill wasn't limited to historic buildings, and if either the representative or the testifier could give an estimate of the existing program proportionality between historic buildings, that were in the registry and qualified for both the state and the federal programs for restoring historic buildings. Versus other buildings in the cities.
Mr. Gasick?
I'm going to try to answer that to the best of my ability. But there's a very small number of buildings that are actually designated on the National Register. I think there's about 6, I don't know the exact number in Minnesota, and I'll get that number for you. But we believe that all older buildings are really important to maintain in communities, because even though they may not be just listed on the National Register, they still are important pieces of our community's fabric.
And
Representative Joaquin.
Representative Quam, I think Mr. Gasick was also explaining that the Historic Preservation Credit is really a narrow tool, that it's very hard to reach that bar for a historic building. We're looking in Hopkins, as Mr. Mortensen said, and purchasing the old Masons building that has a lot of historic value. It's not on the historic registry. We're not sure if we would put it on there. It kind of precludes some of the improvements we'd like to make on it to be able to utilize it for our historical society. So this kind of gives an additive incentive to buildings that can't quite reach that bar, but are still very valuable to the community and still older. So the revenue note explained that possibly 100 commercial industrial buildings across the state would maybe apply that first year. And Mr. Gassick mentioned, I believe, 20 are currently using the historic tax credit.
I think that's about right in the state right now.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I guess I'm confused when you're decreasing it from 45 to 30 years. So now when you're due for your first reshingling, you're considered historic? Or is historic just a very extremely small, minute portion of those properties that would fall underneath this?
Representative Joaquin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwan, that's a good question. The historic aspect, to be labeled a historic building, is a separate issue altogether. And I'm not wedded to the 30 years on the commercial industrial. We just kind of paralleled it with a housing stock. And the reason, one of the reasons why we moved the 45 to 30 in the housing was that we're seeing a lot of homes. One, the program phased out in 2003, and we're seeing a lot of homes that after 30 years do need those major improvements that families need some help making to stay in the house and continue to live in the community. And also, I don't know if a lot of you probably remember, in the 80s we had a little issue with our building codes and ended up with a lot of homes that had black mold. So some of those second-tier suburbs and growing communities like St. Michael, Albertville, might need a little bit help remodeling some of their homes that they have there too. And Mr. Chair, if you'd permit me, I want to make one clarification on the question Representative Kosnick asked about the garage.
Yes, please do.
The program only qualifies a 600 square foot garage to be included in the assessment value, and back at that time that might have seemed large. I'm eyeballing it here, so don't quote me, but I'm thinking the perimeter of the table is about 600 square feet altogether for a two-stall garage, not a three-stall that you see in many of the new homes today.
Other questions, members? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just kind of a clarification question, and forgive me if it was already addressed, but you've mentioned the Masonic Lodge a couple times. I'm just wondering, what is that building used for now? Is it the Historical Society and people tour it, or what is that used for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whalen.
Representative Joaquin.
That's a very good question. It's actually a very old building stuck in between. Literally, their walls are up against two older buildings in our downtown, too, and it's actually still currently a Masonic Lodge. And they were looking to, their membership has dwindled, and they wanted to sell the building, and they were having a hard time finding anybody to buy it because of the updates that were needed. So the city stepped in, and the Masonic Lodge is selling it to them at a reduced price in hopes that it becomes a historic building and is part of our historical society.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Gassick. And Mr. Hamm, are you still here? If you would like to bring your presentation forward at this point. If you'd introduce yourself one more time, sir, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May.
May. I don't know where I got ham from.
It's close. I've been called a lot of
my,
things. So.
My ears are kind of hamstrung. Sorry, Mr. May. Please proceed. Thank you.
I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We are opposed to House File 473. We've been opposed to this old house legislation since 1993 when it came about. And just for information, it's not gone yet. It'll be gone in 2018. We're still phasing it out. I think Hennepin County still has $17 million worth of excluded value on the 2014 assessment. Every year, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers prepares a legislative platform position statement that we hand out, and I think you all received that in the previous meeting. On that sheet, under item 2, A, B, and C, I can read these to you, and our position is that MAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitations on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, deferments, exclusions, or exemption, create inequities between taxpayers. And this old house certainly does that. It shifts the tax burden from those who possibly can afford to make an improvement and the people that don't get to pay a little extra. And that's how it works. The tax does not go away. MAO supports a good tax policy that treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner. MAO opposes classifications of programs that target only a small number of taxpayers. In this area of small number of taxpayers, of course, this bill opens up this old house from 45 years to 30 years, which is a house 1985, which is not that old house, at least in our estimation. MAO encourages the continued use of state-administered programs, such as the property tax refund program, special target refunds, the income tax system, etc., if policymakers wish to grant additional tax relief. In addition, the tax working group that was formed by this legislature and did their work in 2011 and 2012 did a comprehensive study of our property tax system. Many of the things in that report correlate with the MAO's position. One of the things under the guiding principles in that report was that they should base property taxes on market value. Using a value other than the full estimated market value by applying exclusions, limitations, or alternate values creates confusion, complexity, costs, and distortions. They also, as one of their principles, said that we should make simplicity and transparency a priority. A transparent and understandable system facilitates trust and accountability. A simple system is more efficient and reduces errors, unintended outcomes, and high costs. Policymakers must defend these important principles. In addition, they had 19 recommendations on the report. And if we look at recommendation 18, it talks specifically about special valuations and deferrals. These programs increase complexity and decrease efficiency, transparency, and accountability. Their suggestion was to impose sunset dates on all current and future programs to prompt review. In addition, the International Association of Assessing Officers prepares property tax standards that are used throughout the world. In their standard on tax policy, they have a section about limits that constrain changes in assessed or appraised value of property may appear to provide control, but actually distort the distribution of the property tax, destroying property tax equity and increasing public confusion and administrative complexity. I've already mentioned that the Department of Revenue did prepare a report each year on this old house while it was in effect, and that using the 45-year-old criteria in the past, in 2003, we had over $700 million of excluded value and 56,940 parcels that had excluded value. So to sum it up, MAO believes that this old house really isn't the main thing that creates an incentive to repair a house or improve a house. In most cases, it's the affordability, the economics of doing the improvement, and I think in many cases the interest on the financing taken out to do these improvements far exceeds any benefit they get from property taxes. The $5,000 threshold to qualify for this old house, and tax rates, effective tax rates, do vary across the state, as we all know. But at a 1% tax rate for a residential homestead, a $5,000 improvement would save approximately $50 a year. If you had a 1.5% tax rate, it would be $75. So it's not the biggest thing in doing an improvement. With that, I would wrap up my comments and ask if there's any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions for Mr. May? Oh, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. May. Listening to your, descriptive adjectives about this, every single one of those seemed to go for the entire property tax system that we presently have. And when you have the analysis, from a national or international groups, and those comments, wouldn't they also fit well for our property tax system as a whole?
Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they certainly would. They are made, just like the property tax working group suggestions, we're really dealing with the whole property tax system.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned during your comments that it's important to maintain a fairness in the system, and that this distorts the property tax system. I was wondering if you would care to comment on how already distorted the tax system is here on property taxes.
Mr. May. Softball.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I probably wouldn't care to comment on that. I would just refer members to the Property Tax Working Group's report, which I think does a comprehensive job of summing up the condition of our property tax system today.
Thank you, Mr. May. Representative Hertaus?
Wise answer.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The majority of the folks I represent at Wright County kind of share with me that my philosophy that anytime you can lessen the tax burden on businesses and residents, allow them to keep more of their fruits of the labor, it spurs economic activity. And I therefore support the bill, although it does have some areas that I have some concerns with. So two questions, one for you, Representative Joachim, and one for probably Mr. Hines. So the question for you, is this retroactive if this bill becomes law to business owners or residents that have invested in the last year or two? So that's question number one. And then Mr. Hines, question...
Let's focus on the first one first, okay. Representative McDonald. Representative Joachim.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, as it's written, no, it's not retroactive. But like I said, I'm open to any discussion on trying to get to the same goal.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, currently in the great city of Delano, there's a couple of business, a couple of residents that have invested into downtown buildings that are over 100 years old, and frankly, if they hadn't, they would be demolished in the next 5 years. So it's a thrill for us to see that development, economic development, which they did on their own accord with no government help, by the way, but all the help helps. So currently the remodeling is, so if that's something that would need some work on the bill or an amendment, I would certainly offer to offer that. So also just saying, in Hopkins, my grandfather lived there, so we cruised the main street of Hopkins, the many phases that it was in the 80s, so great little town. So Mr. Hines, question, I noticed on the analysis here that, and I was talking to Representative Lenchensky regarding this, the bill reduces the target, the taxable market value for homesteads and businesses that benefit from the exclusion, and then it shifts the property tax, as we already stated by Representative Hertaus. I don't understand that, so if you could help me wrap my hands around that. If all things being equal, if a property increases does some work to it, it increases the value, how does that increase the taxes and shift it to other taxable properties? I'm guilty of, I should know this, but I don't.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, the analysis would simply be that you normally would count that value of that property, and that would in computing a tax of that improved parcel, so they would bear some tax burden. By not counting that value, you're reducing the value, the tax on that property, and therefore the other properties in the jurisdictions are picking up that piece.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's the area that I think we need to have a little reform as well, in how the property is assessed and or taxed.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative McDonald kind of got to my question. I was going to ask for a clarification of how this actually worked along those same lines, that if we're just deferring the increase in tax capacity and then talking about a shift in the tax burden, in the case of that garage, for example, there was no tax on the garage before it was built. So one way to look at this would be that there's not a shift because there was no tax to shift before the garage was built. So could you clarify that again?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, the... Remember that in Minnesota, our system is levy-based. It's not rate-based. So each jurisdiction says this is the amount of money we're going to raise to the property tax system. The county auditor is going to figure out what rate of tax we need to get us that amount of money. So there's when a building gets has its in a normal situation where you count all the value, each value of $1,000 of value is going to pay the same amount of tax. No matter where they are in the jurisdiction. So in order to raise that money, if you're going to reduce the value in one property, obviously the rest of the properties are going to have to pick it up to provide the local governments, the city, county, school district, with the same amount of revenue. Some states have a different kind of a system, which would work more like our sales tax system, where there's just a rate set, and if the value goes down, the government wouldn't collect as much money. But under our system, the local governments collect a set amount of money, and it's just a case of the value is just how you divvy up that burden.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and for that clarification. So are you saying that, again, this proverbial garage that was built with the program counts in the city's net tax capacity but not in terms of the tax collected?
Mr. Hines.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it would normally be part of the net tax capacity unless a program like this would come in and exclude it, yes.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to just make a couple of comments that some things that are kind of been missing from this dialogue that we've been having. With old properties, there's a couple of ways to look at this. If you're targeting as an incentive for somebody to acquire and to repair and as an incentive, in most cases, the market has already made an accommodation in terms of its depletion and its significantly lower value. So if you had what was typically a couple $100,000 property and it is now depleted down to a market rate of $125,000, if you have an incentive to remodel and fix that up because it's commensurate now with other properties. So that is a pretty powerful incentive by itself. For those individuals that maybe are owner-occupied, let's use a residence, for example, and if they've gone through 30 years of occupancy and they've gone through depletion as well, in most cases, there are exceptions, but in most cases, those improvements you make don't really add to the value of the home because the size hasn't changed, it still has a roof. If you replace the roof, you're not adding real value to it. Those are considered maintenance things. So when we heard the testimony about $700 million of tax capacity, 57,000 properties, I did a quick calculation. That was about $12,000 of improvement on average. That really wouldn't, if those were the types of improvements, it really wouldn't be an exclusion. But if it added tax capacity in terms of making, from assessing purpose, if it made it bigger, that would be a qualifying exclusion. Or if it added air conditioning because it didn't have air conditioning, that is something that changed in terms of how you value property. So, you know, a lot of people might think, well, it's just all the dollars you put in it suddenly get this exclusion. You kind of have that exclusion anyway in many regards.
Thanks. Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I do kind of appreciate the concept that we're trying to achieve here. I just obviously have some reservations on achieving those goals. Can you clarify, are non-homestead residential properties excluded from this program? In other words, if you have an older area where a lot of rental properties, and those we're expecting those businesses to hopefully improve and maintain their properties, are they not, they wouldn't qualify for these exclusions?
Representative Joaquin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, that's a good question. I don't know if you're mixing up business. Businesses don't homestead, but I can see where you're saying owner-occupied. There was some discussion around that with the League of Minnesota Cities Working Group on whether or not it could be a tenant in an older building. We didn't include that because of complexity, but something that I'm open to. When it comes to the homesteaded properties, from what I understand, we don't have a difference now in our taxing rate between homestead and non-homestead properties. Maybe Mr. Hines can explain that.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, there is a difference in classification because the homestead gets the exclusion, but the broader question is, the answer is this program, as it's in this bill, would not apply to rental property as it now stands.
Rental
yes.
property.
Yes, so it's just homesteaded residential or business.
Representative Koznick.
Okay, thank you. And that's I think, a good concern to have to try to achieve the effect of the program to begin with, and a lot of individuals that own rental property have it titled in an individual business, just for clarification there. I'd like to ask the same question about second homes or cabins.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Koznick, again, those would not qualify for this program.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Koznick.
And maybe the assessor can help us with this. Representative Heritas sort of alluded to it. Could you give us a feel of what the value of the improvements would be, actual market cost, to achieve the $5,000 in value improvement?
In
other words, I'm kind of getting to, like, how much does a homeowner have to spend in order to qualify? Is it $6,000? Is it $15,000? Or is it...
Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would really depend on the type of improvement that was made and what was existing in the home before the improvement. I will tell you this, that what's put on building permits for improvement amounts and what assessors eventually end up with is two separate things. Certainly, we can have a homeowner expend $50,000, and we probably might not increase the value anywhere close to that, depending on what they did and how much value it adds to the whole package. Because in the end, we have to justify the improvement by how much it adds to the total market value of the property.
Thank you, Mr. One last question,
Representative. Mr. Chair, if you wouldn't mind. Finally, insurance, you know, if someone had a roof and siding, hailstorm came through, you know, a roof could cost $10,000, siding another $20,000, on some, you know, obviously depends on the size of the home. The way I understand it, those are repairs and improvements that are going to be done due to a storm. And would that qualify for the tax credit? Would the homeowner get that? The insurance company get that? How would we tweak that?
Mr. Hines, can you answer that one?
Mr. Chair, I'd rather Mr. May did, if that was a few of you.
All right. Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in those cases, if the home as it existed had, you know, sufficient siding and a roof that we anticipate is in good shape before the storm, we're not going to add improvement value because the same things thereafter, the repairs are done as was there before. If something happens where somebody puts a new roof on and adds a second story at the same time, then of course it changes the structure and we would add value. So it would depend on what's done, but most of the time roofing, siding, painting, those kind of things are maintenance items that don't add to improvement amounts.
I'll let it go.
Representative Vogel, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First might be to Mr. Hines. Excuse me. It would seem to me that since the property tax levy is pooled over and distributed as a result of the assessed valuations, that in this case, if there was some improvements done in the whole base, that commercial industrial would probably pay a higher share of that excess part of the pool because they're assessed at maybe two to three, or they pay at two to three times the rate. Would that be true?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, that's true, but if you think of it in terms of the percentage that each of those properties is paying now, they would each bear a proportionate increase in that burden to pay for this cost. So $1,000 of business property would pay more than $1,000 of home value because they have a higher classification rate, but in terms of a percentage change, it might be an eighth, you know, a tenth of a percent on a home or a tenth of a percent on a business would be the same in percentage-wise.
Representative Vogel?
And Mr. Chair, thank you. So I'm thinking of the town I grew up in, Newmarket, which had a very small downtown area and very little commercial base. And I think that might be typical sometimes yet in greater Minnesota as well. So if indeed there was significant improvements in a community like that and you had a Main Street business that had been relatively new, one of the few on Main Street, and you had a number of these projects going on, their proportionate value then could increase significantly. And that's somewhat worrisome to me because, you know, it's hard enough to put up an improvement in a small town, but then if all of a sudden the burden shifts and you're paying a higher proportion of that total tax, you know, my concern is that, and I'm not sure who could answer that, but my concern would be that we may be disadvantaging somebody that put up a new facility in a smaller town to the benefit of those that might have an older one.
Mr. Hines, anybody? I don't know if that's a question.
Well, the question is, would you be? I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would we potentially be shifting the burden in a small town with very little commercial industrial base from older older buildings to a newer building, because as this shape of the pie of who pays the levy changes, the newer business that isn't going to be able to take advantage of this would pay a proportionately higher share of that levy, because the improvement to the older businesses or whatever would be excluded.
Exclusion. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, it's a good, you're getting into a good question when we use the term shift, because it is actually a little more complicated question than to just say shift and assume everybody's talking about the same thing. So I've been talking about shift previously, it's kind of talking about the shift relative to what the burden would be without the policy change we're talking about. So assuming that we increase values in a bunch of properties, this would be the sort of the logical, the normal way the tax burden would fall. We call it a shift when we change that distribution so it falls somewhere else. But another way that you could talk about a shift is going from year one to year two, or from 1 year to the next. In the case you're talking about, all of a sudden, if a bunch of properties add value that's not included in the tax base relative to the previous year, that you know there was no growth in tax burden, so you're not really shifting. So a business wouldn't all of a sudden, compared to how its taxes in base year one, wouldn't have a higher burden percentage of the tax in the next year. It just wouldn't get the benefit of lower taxes by having all this value counted. But it wouldn't be like if they were paying 10% of the tax in the city in 1 year, the next year they could be paying 12% because the other value didn't go away. It's just they didn't get the benefit of that value coming into the other properties. So if you measure the shift relative to the year before, it can be a little different than if you measure the shift in the current year.
Representative
Vogel?
Does
that make any sense?
Yes, thank you, Chair.
Did I mention this is a pretty complicated area?
Representative Vogel. Did I mention that I'd like to complicate things further? Just one more follow-up question, Mr. Chair, if I could, then. As far as the statewide business tax, would there be any effect on that with this?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, it would actually, when you get into business property, that it brings up a good point. Because of the statewide business tax, all the businesses in the state would get the share in this subsidization of this improvement that's not counted, because the statewide rate would be a little higher. And in the metro area and in the Iron Range, the other businesses in the area would pay some of the burden because of fiscal disparities. So you'd have less money going into the pool. And so it gets a little more complicated, but if you think about all the different types of taxpayers that are affected because of those two mechanisms when it's in business tax, yes.
Because we're basing it on valuation at that point.
Yes, and because it's CI has these other tax bases it's a part of.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Representative
Thank
Vogel?
You. I'll leave you alone.
Members, we do need to conclude this discussion. We've got two more bills before us. Anybody have a really burning question? Thank you, Mr. May. And Representative Joachim, go ahead.
Wonderful, Mr. Chair. Is it okay if I have a few closing remarks?
It is. I want to ask, is there anyone else who would like to testify, who has a burning desire to testify for or against this bill at this point? Thank you. Representative Joachim?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I want to thank you so much for the thorough discussion of this. When I first got on council, it was really hard for me to understand the different taxing jurisdictions and how they interplayed with each other. Basically, what this does is it does not increase the value that's being improved isn't currently there on your tax pool. So when we redevelop in small towns or in towns like Hopkins that are kind of hemmed in, we try to increase our tax base in a way to lower property taxes. What this does is it allows people to increase the tax base, or allows people to improve their property, but it is a lag on getting the property that extra value back on the tax base. So the pie will eventually be bigger. It's just going to take the 10 years to get there, because you're keeping the values all at the same level as they were before the improvement. And as many of you know, we see a symbiotic relationship between improving your property and the properties around you and how they improve. And what I neglected to say about Ms. Billiatt coming up and speaking is she actually lives down the street from me. And when they started improving their home, we lived in a smaller 1949 story and a half. We had just bought it. We didn't have the money at the time to improve. But because the Billiatts started improving and increased the value of their home, and other people did at the end of 2003 when this program was in Hopkins, our value, our assessed value, started to increase too, to the point where we were then able to get equity out of our house and make the improvements we wanted to make. So we benefited from the increased values around us to eventually be able to afford to improve our home. We added on, and we didn't have this old house to do it. We probably would have. It took us longer to do it. But we added on a front and back porch and added a garage and finished our basement over a almost 20-year period. But I just want to stress the fact that this is a way for towns to keep their housing stock up to value and code so people find it palatable to live there. To help, I added the This Old Shop because I really truly do believe our main streets and our smaller commercial industrial buildings need a little bit of help to be able to expand their businesses. When it comes to transparency, I had an interesting discussion with Paulinger from the real estate, from the realtors. One of the concerns they had was the shift a little bit, and then the other concern was the transparency of the process. And he went back to his realtors and asked ones that had been around it when this program was in existence, and to his surprise, he found out that they had no trouble explaining to the next person that bought the house that had utilized this old house, because it stops once you sell it, just explain to the people that your taxes will be different because this exclusion was on there. So there is some transparency in the process built in. I just want to say thank you, and I'm open to having discussions to figuring out a way to just get to this goal if it's another mechanism, and I know they're having the same discussion in the other body. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. Members, thank you for the robust discussion on this bill. And with that, Representative Joachim renews her motion to entertain this bill and to lay it over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Joachim. Our next
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
I'm here on the floor. That's where I feel like I'm sitting today.
You're in the junior chair today, Representative Erickson.
I would like, because as I look around, I think only four or five of us were exposed to the 2011 working group report on property tax reform. I'd like you to pull it out of the archives and provide us with copies again so we can review that.
We will do that, Representative Erickson, the 2012 report. And is that the working group report from 2012? Yes. And as a matter of fact, if we have time in committee, it would be good to do an overview of that. And I was having that same thought as the presenters were talking. Thank you. Our next bill will be Representative Moline, House File 429. Welcome to the committee, Representative Moline. Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for hearing House File 429 today. This proposal did come to me by a CPA in my district who...
Representative Moline, we'll need to move the bill. Could someone move the bill for possible inclusion? Representative Pinto moves the bill for possible inclusion in the committee report. Sorry, Representative Moline, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and again, thank you for hearing House File 429. This proposal came to me from a CPA who is a constituent of mine who unfortunately wasn't able to be here today to testify on behalf of the bill. I think it's probably difficult to get CPAs in here in general this time of year, but when they have to come from 200 miles away, that adds an increased challenge, but Mr. Frank Needle was kind enough to offer to come and speak on behalf of the Minnesota CPAs. Members, my bill may look like it's adding complications to the property tax system, but I can assure you I think it's going to add some simplicity. The reason that I'm bringing this proposal forward, which is to simply expand or extend by 2 months the time to file a property tax refund, is for the purpose because you are able to get a extension of your income taxes until October of each year. And so what CPAs are seeing is people are getting an extension on their income taxes until October, and they're bringing in their paperwork for their property taxes in September, but the time for that refund would have expired in August. And so what this does is provide an additional two-month extension. So for people who have been able to get an extension on filing their income tax returns to October, they will be allowed that same date to file for the property tax refund. So the way it works right now for property taxes that are paid in 2014, the first due date for applying for that refund would be August 15th of 2014, but actually under current law, there's an automatic one-year extension, which brings you to August 15th of 2015. So we know that your income taxes for the payable year of 2014 aren't due until April of 2015, but many people get that extension to October of 2015. So then, like I stated, Mr. Chair and members, they go in to their CPA in September, bring in their property tax statements, but unfortunately that refund, which they qualify for and are entitled to, had expired the month before. So it just provides an additional two-month extension so that they are able to get that property tax refund at the same time they're filing for their income tax returns.
Thank you, Representative Moline. Questions for let's actually Mr. Fragnito, if you want to bring your presentation forward, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gino Fragnito, and I'm the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and I will keep my comments short. CPAs do support compliance and support taxpayers receiving the refunds they're entitled to, and I think this bill does that for a set of taxpayers. The current timing of the dates and with the extensions, it does cause some people to miss that refund that's due to them. So increasing compliance without increasing complexity is a good thing. It would align the dates with current dates that the professionals are working with and the taxpayers is a known quantity. So the October 15th date is one that we work with every day and would not add, I don't think, confusion or complexity to the current tax code.
Thank you, Mr. Fragnito. Questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moline. So you're basically wanting to make property tax refund more like, you know, property taxes more like regular tax, income taxes. Is that correct with this change?
Representative Moline.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, no, I wouldn't say exactly. I would just say it brings it on the same deadline so that taxpayers who filed for an extension of their income taxes and have someone to prepare their taxes for them are still entitled to the property tax refund that they qualify for, but unfortunately had missed the August deadline if they're on that October extension. So that's the purpose of the bill.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be more enthusiastically behind this if it included truth in taxation hearings for income taxes, like it does in property. Make things a little bit more equal.
Well, I'll go to the workshop, Representative Quam. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fragnito. Thank you especially, Representative Moline, for bringing your bill forward. Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 429 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your consideration.
Members, our next bill is House File 457. Bomb. Welcome to the committee, Representative Applebaum. Pleasure to have you before us today, and look forward to hearing your bill. If you could introduce your bill, and we'll proceed. We need to move your bill. Representative Lencheski moves that House File 457 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Applebaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard on this bill. Before proceeding, however, I thought I'd make a couple announcements. Number one, as this is my first time appearing before any committee to move a bill, It is my understanding that treats are customary to be provided, so I have some donuts and apples for your enjoyment this morning.
I see a coming theme, Representative Applebaum.
Well, when your last name is Applebaum, you want to use any advantage to get people to remember you. So, anyway, the second item I'd like to announce before going further is just to state that I have an author's amendment on this bill that I'd like to offer to bring it into proper order. So, Mr. Chair, I would like to move the A2 amendment.
Actually, we'll have someone from the committee move the amendment. Representative Lancheski will move the A2 amendment. Please describe the amendment, if you would, Representative Applebaum.
So this amendment, which I believe is included in the House Research Bill summary, really clarifies some language with respect to the Metropolitan Council and Minnesota Mosquito or Metropolitan Mosquito Control District that, in effect, ties up some misunderstanding with respect to when those entities are provided per their guidelines to address their property tax certification notices. So while the original bill excluded them specifically, after further discussions, it was revealed that that was no longer necessary, and so this amendment clarifies those conversations that we've had.
Questions on the amendment? Members? Hearing none, all in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Well, Representative Applebaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're off to a good start. So I sit before you, Mr. Chair and members, to introduce House File 457, which includes this author's amendment A2, and would align the proposed property tax levy certification date for most local government entities by changing the certification date from September 15th to September 30th for special taxing districts like economic development authorities, EDAs, and House and Redevelopment Authorities, Housing and Redevelopment Authorities, or HRAs. This bill, which is supported by the League of Minnesota Cities, represented by Gary Carlson, who I have here today, Metro Cities, and the Municipal Legislative Commission, is related to a law change enacted in 2014 that delayed the proposed property tax levy certification date from September 15th to September 30th, but only for cities and counties. The 2014 change for cities and counties was requested last year to allow cities and counties more time to understand the impacts of the fiscal disparities programs on their proposed property tax levies. That 2014 law change, however, did not apply to special taxing districts like EDAs and HRAs. Consequently, as the law stands today, a city EDA is required to adopt its proposed levy by September 15th, but the city itself does not have to certify its proposed levy until September 30th. Minnetonka and Plymouth, two cities in which I represent, brought this issue to my attention as greater transparency is needed for residents and property taxpayers when local governments conduct public hearings and hold open meetings for the development of their budgets and levies. Because many city councils serve as the local HRA and EDA and often adopt levies supporting other special districts such as watershed districts, the inconsistent deadline dates can result in confusion for property owners and are administratively inefficient for the entities hearing them. This bill resolves such issues by creating consistent deadlines and creating administrative efficiencies. Importantly, this law, like the 2014 law change, does not alter any of the other dates in the annual tax hearing and notification law, also known as the Truth in Taxation. In addition, a revenue analysis was performed that is included in your packets and indicates that this bill has no fiscal impact. And with that, I'm open to questions, and I'd like to also introduce our next testifier, Luke Fisher, the Administrative Services Director with the City of Plymouth.
Thank you, Representative Applebaum. Mr. Fisher, if you'd introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Luke Fisher, and I'm the Administrative Services Director with the City of Plymouth. And I appreciate the committee taking time to hear some testimony about this important, although maybe minor, issue of moving the preliminary filing date for HRAs and EDAs back from September 15th to September 30th. Each year when city councils and HRAs and EDAs go through the process to develop their preliminary levies, they do a lot of work to understand the tax impact that residents and businesses should expect as they prepare to adopt their levies. Also at that time, the county and other taxing districts are doing a lot of work to understand what tax capacity is and what fiscal disparities impacts will be for each city. We take those numbers and project then the tax impact, and moving the preliminary levy filing date from the 15th to the 30th allows us a lot more time to understand those impacts and really project and be transparent with the public about what a levy may do to them from a tax perspective. This is something that's very welcome, I know, in Plymouth, and we've spoken with city representatives from Minnetonka, too, which really support this as well. Be happy to answer any questions that you may have about this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Mr. Carlson, if you'd introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I work with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'll just be short and thank Representative Applebaum and Representative Davids for authoring this bill. We think it would be a good change and make consistent the property tax certification date for proposed levies.
Mr. Carlson, our second Mr. Carlson, I think he would like to testify briefly too.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the regional center counties in greater Minnesota and 4 of the ring counties here in the metro area. I'd also like to thank Representative Applebaum for carrying this bill. The same issues that have been described as affecting city councils in their certification levies also affect counties in their certifications of the county's own levy and the levies of their HRAs or water management organizations, as a couple of examples. Right now, under the law change that occurred last year, either you don't receive the benefit of the 2-week delay in certification of the preliminary levy, and the board acts to certify both the board's levy as well as its special taxing districts, where the board is also the entity, or you do it at 2 different meetings, causing confusions for taxpayers. So we also support this bill and welcome its enactment if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. A quick question, I don't know, I may have missed it, but is what is the reason that we are excluding, and I know there's a reason, the Met Council and the mosquito control people?
Mr. Chairman, members, the certification of the 2 metropolitan entities' levies is somewhat complicated in that the levy has to be spread across 7 different counties. And so, in fact, it's a 2-step process. One, the overall levy is determined under the statutes that were cited in the amendment through a combination of the efforts of the Met Council or the Metropolitan Mosquito Control District itself, and overseen by the Commissioner of Revenue. But then secondly, they have to allocate that levy to each of the 7 counties' auditors for their proportionate shares. And the practical result is that there have been delays between the overall certification of the 7-county-wide levy and the individual counties' amounts. And because of that delay, There was a concern expressed by the auditors as to whether they would have them timely in order to get the truth in taxation notices out in a timely manner in November. And that's the reason for the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Question from Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Hines has to answer this question. Does this include every special taxing district that we have in the state, aside from the comments that were just made about the Met Council and the Mosquito District? You know, I'm thinking of regional sewer districts that we have in rural Minnesota, et cetera. Will it cover every special taxing district then, so all of the deadlines are the same for certification?
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, all special districts would be covered. The only types of districts that would not come under the September 30th now are townships. But every other type of taxing jurisdiction is covered.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I think this is efficiency. I think this is probably a really good idea. I'm tending to like it.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Appelbaum for presenting this bill. As a former mayor, I support it. But more importantly, I want to give a shout-out to the administrator, Luke Fisher. Luke was the assistant administrator to Delano, to Phil Kern, when I was mayor. And then he was the administrator for the city of Watertown when my father was mayor. And a great young man from Delano. And any time he's attached to a bill, it's a good thing, and you all should support it.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Other questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Appelbaum, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to present this important bill, and I have a new strategy when I come before you again, in that Mr. Fisher will be with me regardless of the topic. So I appreciate your comments and the opportunity to speak, and I really hope that this bill moves along and becomes a law to streamline the important process regarding levies with taxing authorities. So thank you.
Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Appelbaum. Thank you for the treats, too, and Representative Joachim, thank you for the treats. And members, we really have to dispose of this bill quickly, because after all the caloric accumulation that's existing here, we're all going to need to run the steps a few times. But with that, Representative Chair Lencheski's a motion that House File 457 be laid over for possible inclusion, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill will be laid over. With that, thank you, Representative Appelbaum. And members, just a reminder, there's a joint hearing with the Bigger Tax Committee today at 10:15 in room 200 on SFIA and the energy report as well. So any other announcements? And Representative McDonald's headed for the steps, members. Meeting is adjourned.